Welcome, everyone, to tonight's national conference call titled The Truth About Health Reform. My name's Katie Robbins, the national organizer for Healthcare Now. As you know, we're the national campaign supporting single-payer national healthcare. We founded in 2004 to support legislation H.R. 676, Improved and Expanded Medicare for All. It's been such a challenging year for advocates of health reform and especially single-payer healthcare. But this legislative moment too shall pass, and many details about the legislation and consideration prove that this model of reform maintaining the for-profit private insurance industry will be unsustainable, and the need for this movement to continue to grow is more important than ever. So thank you for those who are joining in the call. It appears that we have over 120 guests at this point, and we're expecting it to be a well-attended meeting from folks around the country working on single payer. Before I begin, I want to acknowledge that special greetings have been sent to everyone on the call from the 150,000 strong National Nurses United California Nurses Association. The efforts to pass single payer will continue to be the health reform legislative focus of the nation's largest professional nurses union. Organizers of this call had hoped Michael Leidy of the California Nurses Association would be able to join us, but because of the horrific catastrophe in Haiti, the nurses are currently in the process of deploying 4,500 of their members to help the Haiti disaster relief mission. But we hope to have Michael address our network in the future. And if you are in New York City, Donna Smith of CNA and also of Healthcare Now Steering Committee and Board will speak on the future of the single-payer movement as we pass out of this legislative cycle. So if you're in New York City, you can check the Healthcare Now website for details, and we'll circulate more information from that event later on. Now to tonight's call, we are lucky to have an opportunity to speak with our esteemed panel about the bills being reconciled and the growing movement for Medicare for All. The format of the call will be that each speaker gets 10 to 15 minutes and will follow up with questions at the end. Since we expect this to be a large call, all the lines of the participants are muted. So you can email questions throughout the call to me at info@healthcare-now.org, and I'll field the questions to the speaker. I'll repeat this again throughout the call, but again, the email to forward questions is info@healthcare-now.org. And to introduce our participants in order of their speaking, we have Ronald Heichel, who's the Deputy Chief of Staff and Legislative Director for Congressman Eric Massa, who is a leading advocate for single payer in the halls of power. He is by occupation a political scientist and public sector management consultant. He has taught political science in Canadian and American universities. He was a deputy minister in charge of the healthcare system in the Canadian province of Manitoba and co-chair of the two-person committee coordinating the operations of the Canadian healthcare system. Thanks so much for being here tonight, Ron.
My pleasure.
We also have Dr. Leonard Rodberg, who's professor and chair of Urban Studies at Queens College at the City University of New York. He holds a PhD in physics received from MIT. Along with his late wife, Joanne Lukomnik, he was one of the founders of Physicians for a National Health Program. He served on the board of New York Metro Chapter of PNHP for a number of years as treasurer and research director of the chapter. And we're lucky to have Len with us as well. Thanks for being here, Len.
Glad to be here.
And last but certainly not least, we have Dr. Margaret Flowers, who is a pediatrician and serves as the Congressional Fellow for Physicians for a National Health Program. She also co-chairs the Healthcare Now Maryland chapter and has devoted much of her time recently to building activism in D.C. and around the country for single payer. Thanks for being here, Margaret.
Thank you for inviting me, Katie.
So we'll start with Ron. Please share with us an update from the Beltway.
Thank you, Katie. Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. About 9 o'clock tonight, negotiations will resume at the White House once the Democratic caucuses have been finished at the Mullen Auditorium. And my guess is that these negotiations on trying to bring the House and Senate bill together will likely go on through the weekend, so it will not be before Monday or perhaps Tuesday that some kind of an integrated bill can get sent over to the CBO for scoring, that is for the estimation of the cost. Once the bill is back from the CBO, it would then presumably have to have the requisite 72-hour period of posting before votes can begin. The Speaker announced this afternoon that she was agreeing to a letter received from several members of Congress to a 72-hour period before debate could take place. It is, I think, by the way, entirely possible that once debate starts in the House and a vote is taken, that there could be several ping-pongs back and forth. That is, rather than simply assuming that there would be one vote in the House and one vote in the Senate, I think it is possible that if the bill doesn't pass on a first vote in either the House or the Senate, that it could go to the other place and then come back again. So nobody is certain just how long this process is going to take to play out. As to the issues in play, as some of you will know, there was agreement reached today on the so-called Cadillac excise tax that was a controversial feature of the bill in the Senate. A number of unions, including most particularly the AFL-CIO, were opposed to it. They made that effectively felt, and it became clear a couple of days ago that given the extent of the union opposition to the so-called Cadillac excise tax on higher cost premiums, that there would be a significant change. Now that a change has been agreed to, the major remaining question around this is where is the estimated $150 billion that was going to be raised by the Cadillac excise tax going to come from? And that question, how are we still going to pay for the bill, is still very much in play. The second issue that is going to receive, I think, a lot of discussion and that will be holding people up over the weekend is, are we going to get one insurance exchange or are we going to get 50? In other words, the Senate bill says there will be one in each state. The House bill says there will be one for the country. What lies behind that is the significance of, is there going to be one federal regulator of the insurance, or are there going to be 50 state insurance regulators? Those familiar with this territory will know that there's a general view that a significant number of the state superintendents of insurance are significantly influenced by the perspectives of the private sector health insurance industry, and there's a general sense that they will be less difficult to deal with from the viewpoint of the private sector. So the issue of one or 50 exchanges is going to be something that's going to have to get worked out over the weekend. The third issue, of course, is abortion. There's the Stupak Amendment, which was at the relatively last minute attached to the House bill, and trying to find a way around that one is going to be also, I think, extremely difficult. A fourth issue that's going to attract some attention is the issue of whether or not the McCarran-Ferguson exemption to monopoly prosecution by private insurance companies is going to remain as it is provided for in the House, or is it going to be taken out, left out as it is in the Senate? Another issue that's attracted not a lot of press attention, but I think is very much working its way through the discussions, is the issue of what happens to the employer mandate. There is no employer mandate in the Senate bill. There certainly is an employer mandate in the House. The House would like to keep it. The Senate would like to get rid of it. And some of the people who voted for the bill in the Senate say they won't vote for it if there is an employer mandate put back into the bill that comes before the Senate. There's also the issue of the implementation date. There's been some suggestion that maybe one of the ways to deal with the issue of the $150 billion lost because of the Cadillac excise tax is to delay the implementation but to start collecting the taxes earlier, so that you're not adding any new tax, you're simply collecting it over a longer period of time. And lingering in the background is the ever-present issue of the affordability of care for the poor. I'd also have to say that, unfortunately, from the perspective of those who believe in single payer, as I do, that the public option at this point appears to be deader than the proverbial doornail. Clearly, overall, the Senate bill was the more conservative, the House bill was the more progressive, and more in tune with at least some of the principles of a single-payer system. Unfortunately, from the single-payer perspective, it's the Senate version that is having a greater impact on the final discussions. There are several reasons for that. One of them is that because the bill only passed by exactly the number of votes required in the Senate, 60, losing even one vote guarantees that every member of the group that voted for it has got an enormous disproportionate influence over the final outcome, in particular Senators Lieberman and Nelson. It's also the case that in the House, although a significant number of the members of the Progressive Caucus have made snarly, unhappy noises about the dominance of the overall process by the Senate, few people believe that very many members of the Progressive Caucus are likely to, in fact, jump ship and vote no, having voted yes when the bill came to the House for a final vote. There is, however, a view widespread that is perfectly summed up in a quote from an anonymous senior House Democrat. I assure you it wasn't me, though I assure you it could well have been, reported in today's roll call, which goes as follows. Quote, "The Senate is just a pain in the ass to everybody in the world, as far as I can tell. I'm so angry that I just wish from now on we just find out what it is that Senators Joe Lieberman and Nelson will let us have and then get on with it." The other point to be made, I think, about the disproportionate influence of the Senate is that with the compromise that we achieved today around the Senate-proposed Cadillac excise tax, there's a sense, because that was something the unions were pushing for, that the quote left has now been given something, i.e. the Cadillac tax has been at least moderated by a carve-out being provided for any insurance coverage negotiated as a result of a union negotiation. It's also, I would think, the case that both Senators Nelson and Lieberman believe that they are not yet done bargaining and that it is possible for them to get yet more by way of the shaping of the bill that they're interested in. There's also the paradoxical, in some ways, issue of the $100 million that Senator Nelson got and whether, in fact, it is legally necessary, as some people are now maintaining, for the other 49 states in the union to get some kind of a similar provision. If that were to be the case, that would throw the issue for the financing of the bill into an enormously complex state. So my guess is that what may be happening is that Senator Nelson will be asked to give up on his $100 million. He may decide to do that. But if he does, you can be absolutely certain that he's going to get something for it in exchange. Indeed, a cynic might say that that was in there precisely to provide him with another opportunity to have an ultimate opportunity to influence the final shape of the bill. So at this point, nobody knows what the final bill is going to look like, but it seems to be obvious that it will have an enormous influence by the shape of the bill passed by the Senate. And from the perspective of single payers, that is probably a significantly sad development. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ron. We received a few questions during your discussion, and we'll save those for the end. I'd like to turn it over to Len Rodberg now, Len.
Sure. Okay, I'll try to say a few things about what this plan is. Let me first note that the reason we're talking about healthcare this year and have been for the last few years has been was the extraordinary rise in the cost of healthcare over this decade, in which from 1999 through 2009, the cost as measured by what employers and employees are paying, more than doubled. And so when Barack Obama announced that he was going to make healthcare reform a priority, controlling the cost and reducing the cost was first on his agenda. In spite of that, the bills that are now being discussed that Ron is talking about do little or nothing about costs. The Congressional Budget Office has said maybe the cost increase over the next decade, instead of being 6.4% per year, will be 6% per year. But that's it. There are a lot of pilot programs proposed for Medicare to see whether there are maybe ways to contain costs, but there is nothing inherent in these bills that will contain costs. Instead, what they do is they address the issue of the uninsured, and they address it in the most simplistic way possible, modeled on what Massachusetts did 3 years ago, and that is simply require the uninsured to have insurance, the mandate, the individual mandate, with, I think, as Ron suggested, a very weak or perhaps non-existent employer mandate. So what we're going to what the bills basically do in essence is to say that the way to address the system, the system's problems, is to have more of the current system, to simply add the 15% of the population or so that has no insurance to the insurance rolls. For a long while, of course, there was discussion of a public option. Some of us found it initially in its initial incarnation a very interesting idea, which was basically, as some people in Washington were describing it, Medicare for everybody who wanted it. That is an open enrollment in a Medicare-like plan that people could choose instead of choosing to buy private insurance. As soon as the numbers came out and it was discovered that or estimated that perhaps 120 million people out of the 200 million who are in the private insurance pool would choose it, the Congress went crazy and scuttled any idea that there would be such a public option, and the resulting public option that the House has is a mere shadow of its former self, estimated to perhaps, if it were to survive, involve maybe 2 to 3% of the population, many fewer people, many millions of fewer people than are now in Medicare. So it would not in any way be a game changer if it were to survive, and as Ron said, it looks like it won't survive. Because they have are perpetuating the most costly and defective form of insurance we have, that is private for-profit insurance, they have to subsidize it, but the subsidies are completely inadequate. They have locked themselves into no new taxes, except perhaps taxing our insurance, as Ron was describing. And the result is that the Congressional Budget Office says that people, even with subsidies, will on average be spending, if they buy the insurance, be spending 15 to 20% of their income on health insurance plus the co-pays. So the plans that are being proposed are completely inadequate to deal with the problem of even of the uninsured. You will hear what amounts to a lie. You will hear that 30 million people will be covered by this plan. And the trick is in the word covered, because what that masks is that there are really two ways in which, according to this plan, as estimated by the Congressional Budget Office and Lewin Group and others, will increase the number of people who have insurance. One is by expanding Medicaid to everybody who's below 150% of the poverty line. That would add about 12 million people to Medicaid. It's about 25% increase in the number of people in Medicaid. So to that extent, 12 million people would be covered at least by a public program, as deficient as Medicaid may be in terms of the numbers of providers there are out there who will take it and so on. The other 18 million are not going to be covered. They're supposed to buy insurance. And they're supposed to buy insurance because they're told to, that it's a mandate. The mandate is likely, I believe, to be quite ineffective and much more ineffective than that number suggests, because the penalty is about 20% of what it would actually cost to buy insurance. That is, the premiums will be between 8 and 12% of income, but the penalty is either 2 or 2.5%, depending on which house prevails on that. So my guess is a lot of people, particularly in tough economic times, are going to say, I'll take my chances and pay this penalty. The plans, of course, also leave tens of millions of people, between 20 and 25 million people, with no insurance, uninsured, some because they choose to pay the penalty and some because they get a waiver. It would be determined, according to the current estimate, 5 million people couldn't afford the insurance, that they would be paying such a high price for their income that the government would say, well, you can remain uninsured. So it's a failure even on its own terms. As Ron said, the plan don't go into effect in any in any serious way for 4 years. And that time, costs are going to continue to rise. They'll be at least 25% more expensive than they are now as insurance policies by the time the plans actually go into effect. I think the overall conclusion from our perspective is that the healthcare crisis will continue. More and more people will find healthcare, both insurance and access to actual care, unaffordable. And we will still need real reform. We're not going to have to wait 10 or 20 years for reform. Reform is going to be on the agenda from the day this bill passes because the costs are going to continue to rise, and the same problems that have faced us in the past are going to face us in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Len, for that hard-hitting analysis. Again, we're going to save questions for the end, but for those of you who have questions and are on the call, please email them to me at info@healthcare-now.org, and we'll field them in towards the end of the call. Thanks again, Len. Margaret, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
And we're hoping you can fill us in on, you know, the kinds of activism that's been going on in D.C. and where you see the potential for the single-payer movement.
Sure. Thanks, Katie. I'd be happy to. Good evening, everybody. So I feel like I have a little bit of better news than what Ron and Len unfortunately had to share with you. But from my viewpoint, 2009 was a really remarkable year for single payer. We had a very strong presence both in Washington and across the country, despite many attempts to keep single payer out of the picture. And when I say we, I mean all of us across the country who were activated this year for single payer. I just want to talk a little bit about what was happening in Washington for those of you who may not have been able to keep up with the events throughout the year. But we had a lot of accomplishments. I think one very significant accomplishment was that single payer advocates testified in every committee of jurisdiction in the Senate and the House. Now, some of those advocates were invited to testify, and some were not invited to testify, but we had a presence in every committee of jurisdiction. And we also had advocates who testified in important hearings, like there was one in the House on bankruptcy, which featured Dr. Steffi Wohlhandler, and Elizabeth Edwards spoke as well on the fact that medical debt is the number one cause of bankruptcy. We also held briefings, multiple briefings in the House on health financing and health policy, and those were well attended by staffers and some of the members of Congress. Many of you will probably remember the huge Medicare birthday events that we had in July with a large rally and a full day of lobbying, press conferences, and briefings. And we really had a strong presence that day. We were very visible. And that, I think, had a profound effect on Congressman Wiener and his ability to introduce his amendment in the Energy and Commerce Committee. We had the Mad as Hell Doctors Tour that began in Oregon in September, traveled across the country, hitting 26 cities in 22 states. And they ended up with a rally at the White House. So they had a strong presence coming into D.C. We saw a significant increase in the media coverage of single payer this year. Prior to this past year, you just really didn't hear about single payer, but we did hear it on national TV, significantly in print media, and many radio stations covered single payer advocates throughout the year. As you know, we had the single payer amendments that were introduced in the House and the Senate. The Wiener Amendment in the House made it almost to the floor of the House. It was pulled the day before the vote, and it actually would have been pulled sooner than that were it not for the emails, the phone calls, the faxes, and then some very brave protesters who took over Speaker Pelosi's office in San Francisco, and a number of them were arrested sitting in there. In the Senate, again, the leader, majority leader, skipped over the Senator Sanders single-payer amendment, but because of strong events on Human Rights Day, that was finally brought to the floor. And that was the first time that a single-payer legislation had been introduced on the floor of either body, the House or the Senate, in the history of the United States. So that was very significant. And Senator Sanders did end up having to pull that amendment, but he made a very passionate half-hour speech before it was pulled, in which he said very clearly that there is a Medicare for All grassroots movement, that it's here, it's not going away, and that this will someday pass. Many of you are aware of the mobilization campaign that we had starting in the end of September with peaceful civil disobedience, both in Washington and across the nation. And I think what was significant out of all of this is that the president had tried to keep single payer out from the very beginning, but found himself regularly throughout the year having to defend why he wasn't allowing single payer to be on the table. I think it was significant that now he often feels like he has to make the point that we're not doing single payer. That's because he's feeling the pressure to do single payer. So this past year, we learned quite a bit about what works and what doesn't work. And what does work is our presence, the fact that we were there. As I said earlier, the single payer amendments would really not have come as far as they did if our presence was not felt. We learned that electing single-payer supporters is an important step, but it doesn't make a difference to have them there unless they really have a strong grassroots presence behind them. So many of our single-payer supporters were not able to hold strong for single-payer, not feeling like we had the strong enough movement. So we were there, but we need to be even stronger. And we learned this year the importance of emotion and putting a human face on this. We know that we are correct when it comes to policy. We win on being universal, on being cost-effective and affordable. But policy doesn't change minds. Emotions do. And so we must continue to inspire connection to this issue and caring about the suffering that exists and that is going to continue. So we did quite a bit this year with not having the resources that some of the other campaigns had, but we were still able to make significant inroads and gain some momentum. And so our responsibility now is to maintain that momentum and to grow it even further. Even if health reform does pass, or what they're calling health reform, passes, and that, you know, as soon as they pass legislation, it's going to be heralded as an historic achievement. Our job in the face of that is to continue to grow the momentum for single payer and keep that front and center. We need to point out that the current legislation is not a solution. We need to point out that people still need to get health care. And there will be continued attempts to make us go away, but I think that we are strong and we can continue to be strong and loud and clear that we're not going away. So a few things that we can do, and in one way that it is important, I think, to frame the Medicare for All single payer is that we know that in the United States we have enough money to do this and we have the resources. And if we consider ourselves to be America, where we try to do things well, we need to urge our Congress to pass a health system that we can be proud of, and that puts us in the top 10 in the world. And I think most people can agree that we should at least be in the top 10 in health systems. So we can do this through outreach, and this really is a nonpartisan issue. We learned throughout the year that people of all different backgrounds and ideologies can support Medicare for All, when they understand that, what it is, and that Medicare really is one of our greatest national legacies. It helps families and businesses. So I urge people to reach out to every group in their community. Don't assume, right away that a group might not be an ally, because this really has something for everybody. We also need to educate, and using every opportunity that we have to teach about Medicare for All, attending events, tabling, getting petition signatures. One way to frame this is that we need to have the health debate that we didn't have. Pretty much everybody is feeling like they were left out of the national discussion. And some common ground that we've found everywhere we go is this feeling of being left out, not being heard. But also there's a strong feeling from left and right of not. Are you there?
We're here.
Okay, of being opposed to corporate control of Congress. So both the being left out and seeing the special interest control are things that we can rally around. PNHP, Physicians for National Health Program, is preparing some materials to help critique the final legislation once that is out. Another important thing that we need to achieve is to organize at the congressional district level. Congressman Kucinich emphasized this throughout the fall. It's important to build a database of single-payer voters, and the Montana groups achieved an amazing feat this year where they, I think it's in 22 of their 29 Democratic Central Councils, passed single-payer resolutions. We need to help reelect our single-payer members of Congress, and for some of those who are in big trouble, it may mean that we need to travel to their state to support them, and we need to reach out to new candidates in our districts and bring them into the single-payer fold if they aren't there already. Progressive Democrats of America will be doing this work, and Jane Hampshire of Fire Dog Lake as well. In the state of Maryland, where I am, we're holding a leadership training next month to prepare leaders to be active in every congressional district, and we can share this model if people would like that. We need to increase our media attention, and I urge you to build relationships with your local media and find creative ways to get attention. We'll need to use strategic direct action, having people out, being visible, and being counted as being present for this issue. And I think one of our pressing needs is to fundraise for this campaign. What we can do is we really can. We came so far this year that I think this is the opportune time to really organize and create a strong national Medicare for All campaign. So I urge each of you to find your strengths, use it to its greatest advantage, find what you're good at and what you enjoy doing, and use that, make it fun. Single-payer people are certainly very fun people to be around, and that draws more people in. And I believe that eventually our movement is going to be so big and so well-informed and so activated that we will have huge rallies across the nation, like one that occurred in California just this week and in Washington. And I think that we will have that great march on Washington one day that we've all been hoping for. So I urge you to educate, activate, and agitate, and I strongly believe that we will succeed. Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret, and really excellent presentations from all of our speakers. There's been questions coming in ranging, I'm going to focus on the ones that really emphasize the specific legislative moment that we're in. There's been a lot of questions coming in about the Kucinich Amendment. Those on the call probably know this has to do with the ERISA waiver, and other questions regarding moving states to a single-payer system. Ron, would you be able to speak to some of the points about states having the option to move to single-payer more easily after if this legislation is passed, and how that's shaping up for folks on the call?
Well, the Kucinich Amendment was intended to remove the roadblock posed by the ERISA legislation. It's quite complicated, and I won't go into the details except to say that the Kucinich Amendment was intended to remove that roadblock. Unfortunately, the Kucinich Amendment went the way of the great auk. It was removed through a series of complex negotiations. There is, however, a significant head of steam at the state level. A number of states are actively working on trying to legislate a single-payer system. The state of Pennsylvania, for example, and a number of others. The state-by-state strategy, it seems to me, is a reasonable one to take in the wake of whatever happens to the legislation working its way through Congress. This is precisely what the Canadians did. The system started at the provincial level. It took about 30 years for it to work its way through the provincial level, but eventually the federal government adopted it. And that had the huge benefit of both trying the single-payer system at the smaller state level and perfecting some of the operational issues, so that by the time it was adopted by the federal government, it had been developed over a 30-year period. And since it has been adopted at the federal level in Canada, there has been relatively little significant modification of the fundamentals of the system. And I see no reason why exactly the same thing couldn't happen in the United States. The difficulty with a state-by-state approach, of course, is that you only get to have it nationally if at some point enough individual states adopt it and then prove its worth so that it gradually becomes obviously the only method to solve both the issues of universal access and cost control. But I'd be personally enthusiastic about the enormous benefit of having even a relatively small number of states adopt it and then have it work successfully, because however small that number might be, it would still be an effective demonstration project that lessons could be learned from for the country as a whole.
Thank you, Ron. Just a follow-up regarding the year that states are allowed to implement different systems, opt out of the national exchange. The Senate bill, I believe, had it at 2017, but there's some questions coming in wondering if that is changed or could be changed.
Well, it certainly could be changed, but I doubt that in the next, week, 10 days of the final negotiations, there's going to be much attention paid to changing it, simply because I don't see very many people in either the House or the Senate that are focusing on that. At this point, the attention is being paid to the seven or eight issues that I identified, because those are the ones that either are intensely objected to by significant numbers of members of the House and the Senate, or intensely desired, and I'm unaware of any significant number of members of either the House or the Senate who are prepared to go to battle for steps that would make it easier for states to adopt a single-payer system.
Indeed. This is a question for Len. Regarding your analysis of the bill, do you have any recommendations for being able to monitor the impact of the bill after it's passed? In order to be able to continue to educate the network on the need for reform, do you have any thoughts on how that can be done as we move out of this legislative moment?
Well, it's of course made difficult by the fact that the central provisions of it don't go into effect for either 3 or 4 years, depending on where the negotiation comes out. That is, the exchange doesn't get set up, the mandate doesn't go into effect until then. On the other hand, the taxes start now, whatever new taxes there will be, and the reimbursement changes in Medicare will start now. And there are some benefits that are supposed to start now, but they're very, very limited. There's supposed to be limits on new employer plans in terms of the annual limits on coverage. But what's a new plan? Is a new plan mean an employer shifts to a new company? I think one of the difficulties for us in organizing is that, in fact, this not only do we have the 4-year period to deal with, but also this plan does nothing with respect to people who now get their insurance through employers, except perhaps tax it at some point. And so people will not see a change. One thing we will be monitoring is the continual rise in cost and the rise in number of both uninsured and underinsured, which is going to continue, and it will give us the same arguing points that we have been using over the last year or two, that nothing has changed as a result of this plan, and the same phenomena we've seen in the past few years will continue.
Indeed. One concern that came in regarding, you know, the delay in the taxes, it looks like, will be implemented immediately. But according to Chris Allman, Senator Wyden said at a recent town hall that there would be fees imposed on insurance companies that hike their rates up too high over the 3 years before the bill is implemented. Is that likely to be in the bill, and how could that be enforced? This is for Len or Ron.
Yeah, I don't know whether Ron wants to say anything on it. There are provisions in both bills that would ostensibly limit what's called the medical loss ratio, the percentage of the revenues that insurance companies get to actually spend on medical care. These are very, very difficult to monitor. You don't get the data till a couple of years after the events actually happen, and your tendency is not to believe the data. The state of Minnesota has tried to implement such a limit on to force insurance companies to spend more on medical care and less on overhead, and it's failed miserably. It couldn't get the data that was necessary to actually enforce the rule, and so it's not. At this point, it's not clear which plan, if either, will have those limits, what the actual regulations will be that the federal government will have to design to implement it, and I would not count on it actually having any effect at all or being much leverage for us, because the numbers will be so arcane and difficult to fathom that and easy to fake on the part of the insurance companies, as what they call medical expense versus what they call an overhead expense is an accountant's nightmare if we are from the outside looking in trying to figure out what they've done.
Well, Len's absolutely right. There is a provision in both bills for theoretically limiting the profit of private insurance companies, but it's precisely here that the significance of who's doing the tracking and the regulating becomes critical. If you got one overall federal regulator running an exchange, or if you got 50 separate state exchanges using what would amount to, in effect, 50 different standards of what is financially appropriate. It's also the case that there is a great deal of missing machinery here. We don't know yet what the operational detail will look like because it hasn't been stipulated. And that's going to have a profound impact on the actual significance of any provision for the limitation of the rate of increase of private premiums.
Thank you. This is a question for any of the panelists who feel comfortable answering it. In the bills, in addition to, you know, some of the confusion about how the insurance companies are going to be regulated after it's passed, Can someone please discuss the practice of age rating, even for healthy seniors, which results in a 2-to-1 or 5-to-1 monthly premium amount? There's some conversation about this right now being unconstitutional in nature, according to this questioner. And is anyone comfortable speaking to the age rating that is included in either of the bills?
There are limitations in both bills on the extent of the age rating. They're much more severe in the House bill, much more generous in the Senate bill. The basic purpose for that is that, as we all know, the older people are, the more likely they are to have medical problems, and from an insurance company point of view, the more expensive they get. And it's been a classic element of private insurance underwriting that they will adjust their premiums to reflect that underlying probable cost that companies have to incur. That, incidentally, was one of the weaknesses with the excise tax provision in the Senate bill, in that you could have people paying a much higher premium for the simple reason that they were older and thus likely to be rated more expensive and thus paying a higher premium and thus more likely to be subject to the excise tax only because they were older, which, of course, is an inevitable consequence in any system that covers the entire population. The significance of the age rating is blunted somewhat by the fact that we don't really know how limitations on age rating would be implemented and how stringently penalties would be established if, in fact, companies violated them.
I want to move a question specifically to Margaret. Margaret, you've been very involved with the work with the Leadership Conference for Guaranteed Healthcare, which is a national alliance of single-payer organizations. And some folks on the call are wondering, how can that be expanded, you know, if reform does or doesn't pass, to include the folks that advocated for the public option, and what efforts will be made to expand the people that will be working on single payer in the future?
Great question. That's key. And we know that many of the people that worked for the public option were at their heart single payer supporters. And so we've tried to make in our writing and our press conferences, our presentations, keep that door open that, you know, we all share disappointment in the legislation, and that we in the single payer movement are committed to continue working, and we welcome anybody to join us. So the Leadership Conference for Guaranteed Healthcare is going to continue on through after this, you know, legislation passes, and hopefully we can develop that into the National Campaign of Medicare for All. And any groups are welcome to join that campaign. We are exploring if it's a possibility to maybe have some access to the databases of the organizations that were working for the public option. I don't know if we'll be able to do that, but our hope is to reach out to those organizations which did sign on with the Healthcare for America Now group. And ideally, if we can get increased funding, we can actually hire more staff so that we can reach out to those organizations. But right now, a lot of that will be done on a volunteer basis. So if there are any members on the call who are interested in working on that outreach, certainly contact me.
Great. There's also a specific question. I apologize. I had it right in front of me. Regarding this is from Penny Stenger for Margaret. She says, we're experiencing a lot of public anger locally towards for-profit insurance company. We have a unique opportunity in the spring of 2010 to grow a grassroots effort in West Virginia. Fortune 500 insurance company Coventry Healthcare is a defendant of a lawsuit against a consumer who was treated with discrimination and intimidation. State law prohibits the business in the state from discriminating against anyone with a disability. So Coventry sent the plaintiff, a person with a mood disorder, a letter falsely accusing her of fraud in 2005. But they're looking for tips on how to engage the public to protest at this trial. Do you have any advice for these people in West Virginia with all your experience of protesting, Margaret?
Sure. Well, I'm happy, you know, to work with them as well if they want to contact me outside of this this call. But, you know, a number of us went to the town halls in August when there was so much anger, and we found that speaking to people, kind of one of the tactics we used was to find out kind of where they were. So if they were holding a sign that said, no government-run care or whatever, to ask them about that and find out what they actually know about that. And then in a non-confrontational way, have a dialogue with them about why you see it differently. And it's easy to make these arguments. And so we had a lot of success with that. But it really when you're working with somebody who has a strong opposition to what you're talking about, I found that it really helps to first give them an opportunity to share their views and then share from your perspective how you see things differently and have a back and forth that way. But I think this is really an excellent opportunity to point out the fraud and abuse of the for-profit health industry.
Thanks, Margaret. And I'll just also add that, our responsibility as activists and supporters of single payer moving out of this legislative moment is to look at things that are happening locally. Insurance abuse is not hard to find, and using those stories and examples of people who are wrongly denied care or delayed care is critical for us to raise awareness of. So with an effort like this in West Virginia to draw attention to the abuse of this insurance company and write letters to the editor and stage public protests and get petitions signed asking the state insurance commissioner to defend this person, these are all things that can be done also under the umbrella of the demand for single-payer Medicare for All to end this kind of abuse. So I think it's really important to look locally at what opportunities come up. In Pittsburgh, there's been a tremendous effort around the closing of Braddock Hospital, a community hospital that serves an underprivileged area outside of Pittsburgh, and the single-payer activists there have been joining together with the community to raise their voices about the need to save community hospitals, the need to have a single-payer system that ends this the plague of the closing of community hospitals around the country. So there's opportunities for us to continue organizing even after this legislative moment with the impact on our own communities. So as we're wrapping up, I'd like to put a question to the panelists. And I think that this is helpful to really sum up all the information that you said up to this point. The question is, would any of the panelists support the bill in Congress which doesn't include the single-payer paradigm? And also, you know, if you can think about, you know, the likelihood of people who've supported 676 voting for this legislation and maybe explaining your thoughts on what we can expect in the coming weeks. If each of you could address the pending vote that will be happening likely around the State of the Union address, that would be great. Ron?
First thing I should say is it is not at all clear to me that the bill is going to pass. I'm not predicting that it won't, but it is not certain that it will. There are some complicated reasons for that having to do with some people who feel very strongly that there are certain things that need to be in the bill, and there are some other people that feel very strongly that those things shouldn't be in the bill. And it's hard for me to see how on fundamental issues like abortion or one or 50 exchanges or the presence or absence of an employer mandate, how much compromise on fundamental issues like that is going to be possible. I'd also say that the situation that those who want to continue to advocate for single payer face will be enormously influenced by whether, in fact, the bill in some form does or does not pass. If it passes, then inevitably much of the public debate will focus on the merits or the demerits of that bill, and it will provide single payer advocates with an opportunity to criticize the bill that has passed from the perspective of the merits of a single payer. If it doesn't pass, then I think Professor Grodberg is right. Is very right that there will continue to be a healthcare debate in the country, although the bill was not passed, and that will provide, I think, some renewed opportunity to build on the greater recognition that single payer has achieved, as Margaret has pointed out correctly, over the past year. And I suspect that single payer advocates will find it much easier in that environment to get a hearing than in some cases we found over 2009. So I'd make a fundamental distinction between whether the bill passes or not and the kinds of tactics that single-payer advocates should use depending upon whether we get a bill, however flawed, or don't get a bill. And to answer what I detected was your question, Katie, were I a member of the United States Congress, I would vote the loudest possible no on whatever version of the bill comes forward.
Thank you, Ron. Lynn?
Yeah, I certainly would not support the bill. I think whether it passes or not, one of the central points we have to make is that this bill was not reform. Reform has not been tried. It hasn't taken place. If the bill passes, it won't be reform. The president changed his language and called it health insurance reform. I don't believe it's even that. It attempts to do some very modest regulation of the private insurance industry, but to the extent that our healthcare system needs real reform, this is not it. Even if it passes, we will not have had real reform. We need real reform, and that is something that we're going to have to explain, and that we're going to have to make clear that by real reform, we don't mean what the Republicans mean, which is throw everybody into the private market. We mean that the public sector, the government, has to be responsible for seeing that all of us have access to health care.
Thank you, Len. And Margaret?
Yes, well, many of you may be aware that Physicians for a National Health Program did come out with a statement opposing the Senate version of the legislation, and it's likely that this final version is going to closely resemble that Senate version. So we don't see this as reform by any means. The insurance companies have really had a strong hand in this legislation, and they've gotten many of the things that they wanted. So the way that we would frame this is it's an insurance company handout. It's not a bailout because they're continuing to profit very well despite declining enrollment and the economic downturn. It'll be important for us, if this legislation passes, to go on record very early explaining what is going to happen, what we predict, that healthcare costs will continue to rise, that healthcare needs will continue to be unmet, and that families and businesses will continue to suffer under the burden of these rising healthcare costs, and that ultimately this legislation will not be financially sustainable, and it will not by any means achieve the universality that a single-payer system would. And so I agree with Ron. Our approach going forward will depend somewhat on whether legislation passes or not, but either way, we need to be a strong vocal force.
Thank you, Margaret, and to all of our panelists for sharing their time with us tonight. Healthcare Now remains committed to building the movement, supporting activists around the country. We hope the people who have been on the call tonight found it informative. If there's still questions out there, we're available at Healthcare Now to address them. Again, the email is info@healthcare-now.org, but we'll be ending the call. And I hope you can continue to support the efforts of Healthcare Now as we move into this more challenging time of building the movement. And you can sign up for free email alerts, and if you can, you can donate to support our work at healthcare-now.org. And thanks so much, everyone, for being on the call. Again, we hope this was informative, and we look forward to working with you in the future. So onward to single payer, everyone. Thanks so much. Good evening.
So long. Thank you for having me.